Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this very special episode of The Charlie Kirk Show. We have a huge treat for you in store. A breathtaking episode, quite honestly, with subject matter experts, statistician Aaron Ginn and medical doctor Keith Rose. It's a long-form discussion. They are widely recognized and renowned experts on all things coronavirus modeling, trends, and data. They have some very serious accusations towards Dr. Fauci, and also some information about Dr. Judy Miskovits. We talk about the Bill Gates vaccine and more, and I approach this with some skepticism. You see me press them and ask them very difficult questions about the vaccine, about modeling. Was the modeling right? Can we trust modeling again? We are a fact-first show, and we had to bring this discussion to you. You will learn more about the Chinese coronavirus, the data, the modeling, the projections, the mistakes that were made during this podcast more so than any other out there. This discussion is the one that you should circulate to all your friends. It is a data-driven podcast with two people that are not really even in politics at all. Medical doctor and someone who's a mathematician and a statistician. You are going to be blown away by this episode. Before we get started, email me your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. Type in Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider right now. Take out your phone. Type in Charlie Kirk Show, hit subscribe, follow us on Spotify, and get your friend to do the same. You will learn more in this podcast than any other podcast out there when it comes to the coronavirus. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Charlie Kirk Show. We got a special episode
super,
show.
Super special.
I know a lot of people, I get a lot of emails about what is bothering people and questions that people have. I have never had an influx of questions over the last couple of months of just confusion, uncertainty, and outrage about the data, about people that are prognosticating. And I could not think of two better guests out there that have been right from the beginning, that have been rational skeptics, and that are very well versed in statistics and also medicine. So first is my dear friend, Dr. Keith Rose. He's a supporter of Turning Point USA. He understands epidemiology quite well. And he called me, I don't know if I can say this or not, but I'm going to say it to the entire world. He called me in February and he said, Charlie, lockdowns don't work. And this virus has been here in America longer than people realize. And they're going to try to shut down the country and ruin the economy. Ended up to be correct. On the other side is another dear friend of mine, someone I've known for quite some time. And first time we're actually formalizing a conversation publicly, I guess we should say.
Yeah, because we knew each other pre-Trump.
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
Aaron Ginn, who was written up in the Wall Street Journal 6 days ago as something like who the mob could not silence when it came to coronavirus.
That's true. I'm pretty persistent. Yeah.
Had them for months now, Aaron and I have been going back and forth, and he has been so right at challenging the statistical models. Would you agree, Keith?
Every time. Every time. That's when I read his article in Medium.
Yeah, and they took it down, right?
And I called you, and I said, who is this guy?
And I said, oh, I know Aaron.
And I was like, give me his phone number, you know.
So, Keith, you called me in late February, and you said, I know this has been in this country longer. How did you know that?
Well, there were several things. When it started coming out, I went back and looked at the CDC data. I was in Africa during Ebola, and I didn't even want to be in the same zip code with that. You know, I was working in Africa, and that was bad. And then I dealt with H1N1 when I was over in the Middle East. So I had had some experience with viruses. And so when people were talking about it, we have something the CDC will categorize as non-influenza-like illness, meaning they test for the flu. If it doesn't come out to the flu, then it's a non-influenza-like illness. And I own several clinics. And we had seen a massive spike in non-influenza-like viral pneumonia. And if you go back and look at the CDC data, you see that spike of almost 3 million patients at the end of January through the first week to 2 weeks of February. And I remembered looking at that and on top of thinking about this.
So you're saying that there was a spike in CDC data in mid-January. That was unexplained.
Unexplained. And no one seemed to want to talk about it. Now I don't think you can even go back and find that graph. Yeah. I have it. I think I sent it to you. But it just – when you start looking at numbers like that, and again, science – and just like Aaron said, science, you look for the truth. And it seems like everyone already decided what the truth was and then created the data to form around the truth. And that's when you get those models. And the models – I remember in 2018, it was a terrible flu season. And the models then were the MIDAS. I think it was called MIDAS. Mm-hmm. It was an acronym. I don't remember the exact – but you can't even find the MIDAS model anymore. Mm-hmm. We've shifted over to whoever's getting the recent grants and funding to do our next models. But the thing about this is the models have been wrong every single time, and we weren't adjusting our response to the models. I mean, when the models first came out, we were reacting to what if because we didn't know. When we did the shutdown, I was really digging into the data, and that's when I met Aaron, and we were doing a lot of back and forth. But pretty soon after what if, we got into what is, but we didn't change our response.
Yeah, the evidence, like we continue to focus on projections when the evidence is coming in from our allies, from a much more trusted data source than China, and it's very clear. Just like the example of children, like for some reason, we have theories like the ACE2 receptor. We have theories around that, but like
the immune response in children.
The T cell theory, different right. things around that. But we know from Europe that like these are just not at risk. But for some reason here, like I mean, you can go to the UK, you can go to Sweden, go to Norway, go to Denmark, go to Austria, go to Germany. Like they all say the same thing. But for some reason here, we like don't.
Well, the actual numbers say the same thing now.
Yeah.
They're not at risk. And now they're even coming and showing that not only are they not at risk, but they're not even transmitting the virus.
Yes.
They're not even vectors like we thought.
Yeah.
But you talked about that region in Italy.
Yeah. And when Lombardy,
Lombardy region.
Yeah.
And no one seemed to want to talk about the fact that there are over 300,000 Chinese nationals traveling and working there year-round. No one talked about that. Mm-hmm. No one talked about the older
population. Made with Chinese imported labor in northern
exactly.
Italy.
And they didn't talk about the smoking. They didn't talk about the aged population. And, you know, Charlie, the worst thing about Italy, and my wife has spent a lot of time in Italy, and I've been there, is the socialized medicine. That actual people, their doctor is the ER.
Well, there's other inputs as well that have to be factored in, as you've mentioned, Keith, which is they smoke more than Americans. They also live intergenerationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they greet each other with a kiss, which is a much more close proximity to transmit the disease than Americans.
And their primary care is in an emergency room for the most part, unless you have money. And
so here's something I don't understand from an epidemiological standpoint. How can young people not transmit the disease? Does it just die within them? Or
There are several theories. I mean, they're still studying that. Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling to find the right word, but this was something they said you have to believe in to shut down the schools because they could be little virus reactors.
When what if came out early in the quote pandemic, we said that it lived on surfaces extended periods of time. But when you actually went back and looked at the studies, you realized that was in perfect environmental conditions in a laboratory. And then a lot of studies followed that said it doesn't. And now we know it doesn't. They say that children can pass it off to everyone. And then we started looking at schools. And we started seeing that people that didn't lock down, that were in schools, they weren't seeing blooms or outbreaks. So I think the key point is I can't tell you why they didn't do it, but I can absolutely tell you they did do it. They continued to push a negative, continued to support.
Yeah, we'll get into intentions throughout.
I don't know why they did it.
Well, I want to save the intentions argument, the conversation for once we kind of lay the baseline. I'm just curious how it works epidemiologically, how a human being that might be younger can't transmit the virus.
Some people say their immune system's not developed as much. Mm-hmm. There may not be as much.
That sort of nuance seemed to just be such lacking.
I'm just telling you what's out there right now.
Yeah, like there are a lot of – what's key is like there, you know, scientists are investigating the particular methods as it comes to children, but we know from the actual like infection data that they get infected at a much lower rate for some reason, And as we've seen from the study in Australia, as we've seen from Switzerland's position, that that for some reason they're not vectors, and we don't fully understand why. But
the data shows that.
Well, and it's unique in that it's one of the first viruses that I'm aware of that doesn't affect children, because most influenza and most viruses do affect children.
Keith, would that add, let's just say, data to the argument or support the argument that this is bioengineered?
I think that you can make an argument for that, because we have the first virus that I'm aware of in history that doesn't affect children. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 2018, it was so bad. We were losing 4,000 Americans a week, and kids were dying.
Say that again. So we were losing 4,000 Americans a week to what?
To influenza in 2018.
The mutated form.
The mutated form, I think it was H5N something.
Okay. Yeah. And, but whatever that seasonal flu was.
It was one of the worst we had. We lost over... that the numbers the CDC gives a range, but upwards towards 80, 85,000 people died during that flu season. We had over 700,000 hospitalized. I mean, this was a bad flu season. And I can remember, I'm on staff at several hospitals. The hospitals were at capacity. I mean, ERs were on divert. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. New York was getting crushed with that 2018 flu season. And there were articles in the New York Post about New York complaining there wasn't enough PPE, personal protective equipment, for the staff in 2018 and 2019 in the hospital.
Something, Aaron, that I never quite understood, and I don't think we got a good answer on, in the data, and maybe you might be able to add some context to this of how it progressed, was when Dr. Birx was asked once, and it was such a short question, it was not covered by the media, where they asked her, I think it was actually Jim Acosta, who, surprisingly, asked a pretty fair question where he said, look, some skeptics are saying, what actually counts as a COVID-19 death? Mm-hmm. And she admitted, we are taking a liberal approach to counting deaths. Am I correct in saying this, Aaron?
Yeah, the White House has actually been very transparent about how they will be tracking COVID. And
how is that?
Which is, if it appears, usually there's four line items on the death certificate. And if it any way appears with the specific coding of COVID, it is counted as a COVID fatality. So now, I guess, Dr. Birx is rumored to have now been challenging the CDC's position on that, as it was leaked in Axios, I think, last week. And Governor Polis was the first state to do reaccounting of those fatalities. And he removed about 25%.
Wait, what? How?
25%.
25%, he
said.
Off
the top line number.
Yeah. So those are people who died of and not with. And so we still don't know the exact line item of where it appears on the death certificate. But people should be aware that, as one physician told me, writing out a death certificate is, he said, called the dark arts, right? It's really based on the judgment of the physician. But I would say that the one is that it was incorrect for the assumption to be that people don't die of underlying conditions. That is fundamentally not correct. I mean, even the CDC website says the number one cause of death is heart disease.
Well, that was shown in Italy when they started looking at the autopsies of these patients that they were calling COVID patient deaths, and they were dying of heart attacks, strokes, things like that were the primary cause of death. So that was – it was reported on in the Telegraph, in fact. I think they had 16% of their deaths.
So I want to focus in on this. Jared Polis, Democrat, governor of Colorado.
Yeah.
Has taken a step back and done something that is just an independent-minded action.
Yeah.
And you're trying to tell me that the Colorado death toll has been readjusted by 25%.
Yeah, so they actually break it out now by died of and died with, which is like –
So what would the – as best as either of you can explain it, can you build that out?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Died of would mean that you
it
got
was a
COVID-19.
Contributing factor?
No, died of means you got COVID-19. You were healthy. You got COVID-19. You progressed in the disease cycle, meaning you went into a cytokine storm. They had to intubate you, whether they treated you correctly or incorrectly, however that happened, and you passed away from specifically COVID-19. Died with means that you may have had a heart attack, and you go to the ER, and they're treating you for
that.
The heart attack, and oh, by the way, you're positive
That's
for COVID-19.
Helpful. That's helpful for me, but maybe both of you can build it out further. That doesn't count in comorbidities, though.
No,
with the died of, is that correct?
No, and because
you said healthy, that's not necessarily.
Well, we have, you know, case studies out there of people 80, 90 years old that get COVID-19 that live, and this is my opinion, but I'm seeing this in the science and data. There are two things that we need to be looking at here. One are the patients with the comorbidities that are more susceptible, like severe active lung disease. Patients with other comorbidities like out-of-control diabetes, things like that. Patients that would have a shortened lifespan anyway due to the fact that they had severe disease. The second thing we look at is how patients are treated, because patients that are treated when they catch this cytokine storm or they take hydroxychloroquine, zinc, azithromycin, and other regimes that have been shown to help early seem to recover. So I think it clouds the data a little bit. When you look at data, you have to put them in the category. You can't just say they died of COVID-19. They should all be treated the same way and then
sure.
look at the deaths.
So Aaron, going back to the data, for me, as just being, for lack of it, from a layperson, just a regular person looking at this that has, I think, some capacity to reason.
Hardly lay, I think it's.
Yeah, I was going to say.
look at the room we're in right now. It's hardly a lay person.
What I mean is that I'm looking at this just as an outsider. Logical, rationally.
Yeah.
I looked at the Grand Princess cruise.
Yeah.
So can we take a step back in time, back in the time machine? Grand Princess cruise, for those of you that may or may not remember, cruise ship off of what coast? Was it Japan?
Yeah, they end up mooring in Japan.
They moored in Japan.
So it was a very unique case because it was recirculated air, contained population. We quarantined everyone after, right? You couldn't have designed.
From a medical study standpoint, it was the most consistent with variables that we had control over and that we understood.
Now that we have that piece of data, is it actually consistent with what we're seeing?
Yeah.
Could it have been instructive?
It was. I mean, for many, it's used it's used a lot in papers, right? Because it is such a nice, clean case study. And I mean, you still have to do age adjustments, things in that.
And
terms.
They did age adjustments, yeah.
Which actually lowers,
yeah.
which actually lowered yeah. the case fatality rate. Yeah. The interesting thing about that was when that information came out, and I read that study, and Aaron and I, we talked about it. People that I feel like were more intellectually honest would discuss that, but the people, the experts that were doing the modeling, the people that were talking about lockdowns, about masks and things like that, and about aerosolized transmission, they weren't even mentioning it. And I just find it intellectually dishonest to at least not bring it up and explain whether it's good or bad.
So now looking at the data, the Grand Princess cruise could have actually prevented lockdowns if we would have looked at that piece of data.
In many ways, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
No, I'm just curious as we're seeing the data continue to come in, who most at risk we know are older Americans with pre-existing underlying health conditions.
And in a healthcare setting.
In a healthcare setting. Yeah. And in a collapsed setting like nursing homes where there's frequent or large family units where there's frequent contact, heavily dense populations. And, I mean, this is not new in medical science. We knew about this during the Revolutionary War when they had the smallpox outbreak. It was only in the big cities. It wasn't out in the countryside, but it was in densely populated areas. That's where viruses have outbreaks. And it was, like, to your point, it was a great reason why we shouldn't have lockdowns in addition to all the other actual science and data that we have that we shouldn't
have lockdowns. We'll get back to lockdowns just one second because I have a question for you both on that. But to close it out with data, as we've seen the statistics come in, do we see anything in particular that over the last couple weeks that we have learned new that we didn't know maybe at the early May that continues that would argue for the continuation of these lockdowns?
I would say it's hard to see because I would say no because I mean then again I mean I don't know what I don't know but there. If you really truly break out the data in terms of the fatality rates, and you actually break it down by location, I mean, if America actually put more energy into Segment and Shield in terms of nursing home facilities, on care facilities, home care, I mean, we would have hopefully reduced. I mean, that would have minimally impacted 50-70% of our current fatalities.
As a physician, we've never locked down.
You answered my question.
Love.
Who came up with this idea, Keith?
My understanding, and I did some research on this, back in 2006, President Bush tasked two physicians in the White House. I believe one was an oncologist, the other was an ICU doctor, neither with any experience in infectious disease.
Oh, they're talking about the high school paper.
Did is they went out and they were looking. It was, again, medical bureaucracy, and they were looking for scenarios or ways to treat a pandemic, because they were concerned about the pandemic in 2003. Mm. I believe it was swine flu, or no, it was bird flu back in 2003.
Mm-hmm. The avian flu.
The avian flu, and would it happen again? And ironically enough, there was a gentleman with the last name of Glass who worked for the Sandia Labs out in, and he had a daughter who was a senior or in high school. I'm not sure what age she was. And she had written a paper on social distancing, and I'm paraphrasing, lockdowns for a sociology / science class. And they actually used her paper, and he put her name on this paper in research. They published it, I think it was volume 11 or 12, in Research Journal. And when it came out, the actual medical institutions, Johns Hopkins, led the charge to say that would be, their words, not mine, a catastrophe for the population.
So let me get this straight. That was the first that we can trace the popularization of this idea of lockdowns.
Correct.
To a high school essay contest in 2006.
I don't know if it's a contest, but we can definitely trace it to
paper.
And
that's
paper,
New York Times
actually.
Reporting. So, I mean, they reported
it
as
so let me get this straight. We shut down the industrialized world that will now result in hundreds of millions of people being in abject starvation, if not risk of death.
Well, to be specific, I mean, like, so she wrote mostly about, like, social distancing. The conversation specifically about lockdowns in terms of this application really came as a belief that because Hubei locked down and they beat the virus, that was what we needed to mimic in terms of non-pharmaceutical intervention.
Well, and that's what Hubei said they locked
yeah,
down and
yeah,
beat
so
the virus.
So
we're trusting China's yeah. words that Hubei did it. So, and I'm sitting here thinking, we have a problem with China to begin with. They're not our friends. They've come out publicly and said that. Anyone who's read Unrestricted Warfare, which is a very interesting book, talks about how China wants to dominate and what they would do to dominate. And this is actually a page right out of that book. And that was written, I believe it was written by someone in the intelligence agencies, talking about the potential for this type of problem. Mm-hmm. And so we have China, who we know is adversarial to us to begin with, at least covertly, if not overtly.
I want to tell you about a super important partner we have now on the Charlie Kirk Show, PCmatic. They build the wall around your computer against foreign adversaries that want to hack your computer. It's PCmatic. PCmatic is a whitelist, next-generation antivirus system that is designed to stop modern threats like ransomware. The cool thing is that independent testing, the AV test, just named PCmatic as a top performer in the cybersecurity industry, giving it the Best Performance Award for 2019 because American research, development, and support. PCmatic's competition is made in foreign countries, many where the viruses originate. PCmatic blocks annoying and malicious ads for hassle-free web browsing and makes your computers faster, more reliable, even after years of use. PCmatic protects Windows computers, including XP Vista, Windows 7, 8, and 10, Windows servers, Macs, MacBooks, Android phones, and tablets. PCmatic is just $50 for 5 devices for 1 year with a full 30-day money-back guarantee. And if you act now, PCmatic has offered my listeners a free month of security protection with the purchase of an annual license. To access this offer, go to PCmatic.com/Charlie. That's PCmatic.com/Charlie again to get this world-class security that keeps your computers running great. Go to PCmatic.com/Charlie. Build the wall. Build it wide. Build it high. Be strong against the Chinese Communist Party trying to hack your computer. PCmatic.com/Charlie.
So it's
is there potential credence to the idea that China was embarrassed that this might have leaked from a lab, which it's more and more clear that it didn't start in a wet market.
Yeah, they didn't sell bats at that market.
Yeah.
And that type of bat was 600
there,
miles
yeah.
away. Yeah. That China screwed it up. We don't believe any of their data. Probably a lot of people were infected, a lot of Chinese smoke. They didn't do much to restrict it from the rest of the world. But is there any credence to the idea that the Chinese would have tried to push a global lockdown strategy to try to
– Oh, absolutely.
Do you think that it's
– I don't think that's past – the possibility.
I'm just asking the question.
I think it's a good question to ask, and I don't think something you could rule out, because China sees themselves as a dominant world power, and they're a communist society. So their locked down. I mean, we were watching prominent scientists and journalists disappear during this time. I think that's our first clue that
do
maybe they don't want us to know.
To these people?
Not to the female doctor.
Not to the female doctor.
Yeah, the ophthalmologist, I believe he died, I think.
But in my understanding, and I have some friends that work in China, and I know some other doctors that have worked there in the past, is that they went into, quote, lockdown, and China has a very strong control, being a totalitarian society, over their population. So I don't say we discount what they say, but I think we have to look at it, again, like the models and everything else, from an optic of, well, there needs to be more information before we make this decision.
So Aaron, one other thing that I'm trying to just understand is it was the continual moving of the goalposts.
Mm-hmm.
And the prolonging of dates.
Yeah.
Right? So it started with slow the spread to stop the spread, which fundamentally is linguistics or semantics, but stopping the spread of the virus is very, very, let's just say, metaphysically and biologically something I'm not really sure.
It's absurd, but yeah.
Okay, yeah. And I'm talking about the medical people around the president. The president isn't phenomenal here. He's been on the best interest of the American people at every single turn. Totally support him and what he's done. I'm questioning the medical community, the medical experts, and the intelligentsia around it that had all this confidence around what they were saying and how they were saying it. But it seemed, Aaron, what I understand is they moved all of a sudden the lockdowns to April 30th. You might remember that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Was there any data that instructed that at that time?
No. A lot of these dates are, even if you look at the symptom onset curve, they're arbitrary. Right? They're
completely arbitrary. There's no data that supports it.
We're just arbitrarily making these decisions. Why? I want to get there in a second. I want to lay the baseline of where we are, and then I want to get into the intentions.
You jogged my memory.
It's somewhat speculative.
When you said this about China pushing the lockdown, they did make a big financial play right after we went into lockdown and the economy
crashed. The Wuhan Health Organization.
They bought a lot of companies that were American-owned companies in China. There were some companies that were in financial extreme, and China made a several billion-dollar play. So whether they gave us the right information, they didn't act like lockdown was the answer. While we locked down and the economy shrunk, theirs actually grew.
So I don't know about the how – I haven't been tracking closely in terms of like how China's sort of taking advantage of the situation. But you know, they did recently announce that there's no more masks in public. That came out the other day. So, and you know, their friends that are eating out in Shanghai and basically Beijing is normal. But going back to that one thing you said about like why are these dates continuing to move? It's because politicians are operating under the precautionary principle, which is fundamentally you have to prove something is safe, which is how a lot of epidemiologists work. Like in terms of like that's just like their trained thinking is that you need to like, you know, they look at the curves and they look at the viral outbreaks.
But that shouldn't be it should be a multivariate analysis.
And this is the one time I'll probably ever disagree with Aaron. And I understand why he says it because it makes sense. But again, we're talking about the politics of this. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the precautionary principle. But what I see is what's the benefit or the gain from staying locked down? This isn't political. This is just looking at the landscape. I do support our president. I think he's done an amazing job, and I just thank God that he's there. But he has medical experts that are advising him. And where I have a problem is where a, quote, medical expert is working inside the government. Mm-hmm. Because in science and medicine, we seek truth. But a politician, a dyed-in-the-wool politician bureaucrat goes for power. And truth and power cannot coexist, to use that word. They're antagonistic. So when you have someone who's been a, quote, medical expert like Dr. Fauci for a long period of time cementing power, then the truth is usually the first casualty. And while that may be the first casualty in politics, when you're dealing with science and medicine and people's lives, it can be a tragedy. Mm-hmm. And there might be some people that would recognize the fact that it's going to be an election season. President Trump one of his strongest suits is getting out in front of people and talking to them. I mean, you can't get in any of his venues. He fills them all up. There's lines as far as the eye can see. And so it could be that one party looks at that as an opportunity to prevent party.
We'll talk about that. You mentioned masks. Keith, do masks work? Should people wear masks?
I think sick people should wear masks. But I've never, again, this is, we, masks were originally, we put masks on people that are sick. If someone comes, a good example is tuberculosis. If someone comes into a clinic and we suspect tuberculosis, we put a mask on them. We don't put a mask on everyone else in the clinic that's healthy.
So when I have to fly on an airline, does it make sense to make sure everyone wears masks?
No, it makes no sense. In fact, there's been several articles out on the health problems when wearing masks, where if you have someone that may have reactive airway disease, and depending on the type of mask, they're breathing their own CO2. It could make them lightheaded. They're breathing their own germs. I mean, our bodies are not basically encased in this wonderful bubble that protects us from everything. And it's okay because we have an immune system. We need to get out. I mean, kids that go to public school, they get sick and they get immunity. And we need to be out and getting immunity. And when you give people masks, one, I think it's a false sense of security because they're not sealed. You can, mm-hmm. people touch them. They're constantly moving them. I mean, I went to the convenience store the other day and their lady's wearing a mask behind the plexiglass, but she touched every one of the items I bought. Mm-hmm. She touched my credit card when I handed it to her and handed me back, you know, mm-hmm. so it's, we're not preventing anything. So I think it's doing something to do something. And I think there's maybe, and the other thing, Charlie, is there's a lot of fear out there right now. There's a lot, I mean, if you listen to a lot of the news reports, people, I mean, you don't have the intellectual firepower of Aaron with you all the time. Not everyone's a doctor. So some people hear this and they believe what they hear. And so then, you know, a lot of decisions were made based on this. So you can't just go, oh, we were wrong. How many times do we hear a politician go, I was wrong?
Well, and so there's now, the media is shifting gears now. And I heard someone say on television the other day, and I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to overly out him. But he said it does no good for us to go back in time to try to find out who made what decision when and try to find out what mistakes were made. We all have to look towards the future. Aaron, do you believe that?
No, because I'm very concerned that we will continue to use this non-pharmaceutical method as a means of virus, like viral infection mitigation. And I'm concerned that we will walk away with some, you know, evidence from what we've done and be more of a confirmation bias than actual provable that this actually did something. Like if you can prove it worked, then by all means, like, prove me wrong. Like, I don't care about being wrong.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that. So you follow these statistics every day. I got a COVID-19 daily update from Aaron.
I get it. And
it's unbelievable.
I live by it.
And it's incredible. I want to commend you on it. Yeah, if you guys have questions for Aaron, by the way, email right now, got them on the screen, freedom@charliekirk.com. And while you're at it, help us beat Rachel Maddow on the podcast charts. Type in Charlie Kirk Show to your phone right here and hit subscribe, and we can just see that us go up. Aaron, you follow this data daily.
Yeah.
Masks, states that are opening, like Georgia and Florida, what are we seeing? States that are saying closed, what are we seeing?
So I think that what we have to walk away with what the actual data is saying is that this virus, in terms of massive outbreaks, severity of illness, viral loads, is highly dependent on the location. And even in the sense of Georgia, which is a massive,
you mean
state,
geographic location?
No, as in like physical space, right? Like,
okay,
as in
proximity
even,
or
population density.
Yeah,
but, and we're pushing people together.
Well, even in that sense, like, you know, if you look at something like Japan, right? So Japan has been one of the best performing in the world. They basically have the Sweden approach. Like, they never locked down because they don't actually.
Japan didn't lock down.
No, they did not.
So why is it that Sweden is kind of the talking point and Japan isn't?
Because one is that I think that it's hard to understand why Japan is succeeding. Like, it's easy to understand, like South Korea's approach, which is testing and massive testing, right?
Basically, like a robotic.
Yeah. It's much more easier to understand from like a Western perspective, like about why that's working. But from Japan, it's like they wear masks, they distance. They all go to work. Restaurants are still open.
Really? And restaurants are open in Tokyo.
Yeah, they're allowed to open until, like, I think 8 or 9. And actually, they released the quote-unquote national emergency across, I think, almost 75% of their country. There's only, like, 7 or 8 precincts are still, like, under quote-unquote emergency orders. But even those emergency orders, like, because of their constitution, they're not allowed to do shelter in place. It's against the law there. So they can only recommend
the
Japanese constitution is more adhering to Lockean first principles than the United States
Well, same with, like, Sweden, like, both Tegnell and Gesicki.
Don't get me started, because I just have to interject here, and I want you to complete the point, which is I have to go on college campuses and hear about how great Sweden is from all these leftists.
I know, it's ironic, right?
And now all of a sudden I'm complimenting the very country that I'm like, no. They're actually awful except for these couple of things. But they're awful. And now it's they preserved first principles better than we did.
Well, I know, and that's the point of like why you should show that you're being intellectually honest, right? Is that like I disagree with Sweden in several ways around entrepreneurship, about taxation, about the welfare state. But here they have been, I believe, will be right. And you have to look at, I think, properly compare data, not only in a sense against Norway and Denmark or the surrounding countries, Finland, but you have to actually also compare them in the sense of, like, you need to look at a demographic range, and you look at, like Sweden has some of the highest number of nursing homes in all of Europe. Like, you have to learn how to, like, balance both.
Wait, so Sweden has the highest number of nursing
homes.
They've
had an uptick. Yeah. They didn't quite protect their nursing homes and they admitted it. They came, and that's what
America,
I loved, I liked about it. But, so they actually admitted their mistake.
So the Swedish model, they admit that they didn't shield the nursing homes.
They came out and said it.
But the restaurants, the young people, they realized that there was almost a – there was an uninterrupted life flow that was able to continue.
Yes, and I think that's what's important. From, like, you know, we have to wait and see in terms of the economic data and the overall, like, sort of fatality at the end of this year. But I think from a both, like, still establishing the trust in terms of the government, I think Sweden comes out ahead in terms of many of the countries they shut down, in terms of, like, not severely affecting the daily life of people, like, they're not making us scared of each other. Right, Sweden.
Schools are open.
Yeah, schools are open. Right, and if you actually look at fatality data, one of the most interesting like sort of segmentation of data you can look at is if you look at the total number of kids in primary school, children age in Sweden, right, and you compare that across all the countries that actually locked down, you would theorize, right, if children are high vectors of it because they didn't shut down primary school, you would theorize that, like, you would see a crazy number of kids infected, and you don't. It's actually one of the lowest in all of Europe. Right?
It's the best explanation for not – for opening schools, actually.
Yeah. Denmark has reopened schools. But close the point, Aaron, where you're saying about the United States, state-by-state data, Florida, Georgia.
Yeah. So people forget that, like, we had, I think, five or six states that did not close, right? So the Dakotas.
South Dakota was the most famous.
Yeah, because she actually stood up for her state and believed in federalism. So props to her. And she resisted the pressure to lock down nationally. But, you know, you look at the predictions from, like, Georgia, from Florida, to remember the protests in Michigan.
Yes.
Remember the voting in Wisconsin. Like, you go through – we actually have an academic paper about the Wisconsin voting show. There was no increase in terms that they could tell just by voting, right? And then now we're looking at Texas. But even that, we have to understand that case data, like, separates signal and noise. Like, the most important thing that we should care about is what type of person gets infected. And in that sense, we have to look at hospitalization data and the people that, because we don't have data on people who get cases. Like, we don't have demographic data. But in terms of hospitalization data, we get a lot of that. And we have to know where these people came from in terms of,
and
like,
it's
the
been like
from
pulling
home.
Teeth to get that data. But which, to your point on those states, the I think the most important metric on this is who's dying actually from the disease. Mm-hmm. And per a portion of the population, like deaths per 100,000. And what the data shows is that they broke it down into five groups. And the lowest death rate per 100,000 were the states that didn't lock down.
Yep.
And the highest death rate were the states that are still locked down. So, and it follows less lockdown, less death.
As you know, there's no NBA, NHL, or Major League Baseball. You might think there's nothing to bet on, but you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on, from their online casino to poker and blackjack, as they are bringing the Vegas to you. If you miss the NFL, no problem. BetOnline has daily Madden NFL 20 simulations you can bet on. If you're into entertainment betting, you can still bet on Big Brother, stock prices, and even the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. All open 24 hours a day and all online. Visit the website or use your mobile device and join today to receive your new welcome bonus. I can't wait to see Joe Burrow play for the Cincinnati Bengals. I can't wait to finally see LeBron James choke in the NBA Finals. And I can't wait to see the LA Dodgers blow a lead that they probably had to just dig so deep to go back to Choke City. LA Dodgers, they can't win the big one, practice. So be ready to be able to wager on the Cubs winning the World Series, the Ducks winning the college football playoff. These things matter because sports are coming back. Visit our good friends and exclusive partner at Podcast One, BetOnline, to take advantage of the best bonuses of the business. Sign up for a free account and make sure that promo code Podcast One for your sign-up bonus. Visit BetOnline.ag. Don't forget the promo code Podcast One for your sign-up bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
Aaron, I want to ask you a point about the data and the narrative. Get a lot of questions with this. Before I ask, we have a lot of new viewers. We have great numbers right now. So I just want to reintroduce everyone because they kind of bop them out.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Dr. Keith Rose, dear friend, someone who has been right about the coronavirus, COVID-19 all along, Aaron Ginn, master statistician, and also...
I'm just a skeptic.
He had the most viewed Medium article that got taken down by Medium that basically it said, thinking clearly in coronavirus. That's my working title, but it's about right. It's facts over something.
Evidence over hysteria.
Let's talk about evidence. Yeah. I get a lot of questions about this. Does the coronavirus disproportionately affect communities of color?
Yes. And that is because we have a couple of theories, but one, it does show up in Louisiana data, is just the sort of underlying conditions that is more prevalent in terms of communities of color. So that's one. And so that the White House has publicly talked about that. And that is true in terms of the national data set. The second is that because of the type of usually work that people in minority communities participate in, that also has increased their overall.
So, but let me ask you: has anyone or yourself yet broken it by income level, not by race?
No. So the data I've seen is from LA and from New York and from Louisiana. It basically makes assumption in terms of the outbreak. If you break out the data in terms of demographics in an area by income, and they make some other sort of adjustments.
The reason I ask is I think it would be more fair to say instead of it disproportionately affects people of color, it would disproportionately affect people on the lower income ladder.
But you're right in terms of like
because
how
the explanations you gave were not necessarily about any sort of characteristics.
Like the virus doesn't care what you look like, right?
But
individuals tend to have more comorbid problems.
Yeah, that's right.
Diabetes, obesity. Mm-hmm. And obesity can affect you as far as, especially with this virus, it causes something called Pickwickian syndrome where you have more pressure on your lungs. It makes it harder for you to breathe. Mm-hmm. And we see this in lower incomes, the virus doesn't see what color you are, nationality.
That's right.
It doesn't care. Sure. But it does go after – I mean, it can affect people with comorbid problems in lower income areas. We don't see – you can see more of that.
Yeah, and also it also relates to, like, people in lower income communities generally have a higher density household. They generally have a smaller household. Versus as Dr. Gupta says from the University of Oxford, that lockdowns are a luxury, right? And so she's been very vocal, and she just has a recent video up by Freddie Sayers being interviewed in England. So she's famous for the person. She basically was the first person criticizing the Imperial College model, which is she was a reason why they released an updated model a week later. And so she's been very critical of the lockdowns, definitely from the perspective of like its overall impact on vulnerable communities. But from a primary perspective, like the evidence isn't there to warrant that.
Well, and no one's looked at what I think would be important variables. Like instead of looking at race, I would like to see it compared the comorbid conditions in low-income communities versus the incidence of severe coronavirus in low-income communities, mm-hmm. and then look at and see how they correlate because you might find a correlation there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that completes the question then for me, Aaron, and it's helpful because a lot of people are wondering, what do these statistics actually mean? What is this upward tick of the death count? Mm-hmm. And so I want to get into the second part of this, and Keith, you'd be able to be helpful, and you could add some macro data to this. I feel as if we've been hypnotized to believe the only thing you can die from is coronavirus.
I know, right? It's kind of – Did you understand
what I'm saying? I think it almost feels as if – we have suspended all over forms of death except from dying of the virus.
Well, and in New York, they almost did that. I think I mentioned this to Aaron in one of our calls. When I couldn't operate, I'm a surgeon, so I couldn't operate for 3 weeks. Mm. And so I started really digging into the peer review studies, looking at the data. I pulled the data from the New York State health statistics from 2018 and 2019 and 2020. And they have total number of cases of influenza and total number of cases of, non-influenza. And there's a number there. And that number, and I broke it, it's broken down into weeks. And to make this very simple, I took 1 week, the last week in April, I believe. And it was around 8,000 cases they had in 2018. And it was broken out, influenza, non-influenza was fairly almost equal, maybe a little slanted to one side or another. In 2019, it was similar, the numbers. But then when I went to the coronavirus, they had coronavirus cases, and it was within 30 or 40 patients, the same number of patients. Yet, so let's say there were 8,500 patients, mm-hmm. 8,480 of them were like coronavirus, and the rest were like influenza. So it doesn't shift that much.
So Keith, you might be best able to answer this. You've opened your practice now in Texas, and you're
right.
You're
we're allowed to operate now. Yes.
And so, but you were warning early on that emergency rooms are wide open, that they're not seeing the cases that they should see.
Yeah.
I was getting calls from you in March on this. You say you don't understand. This is not trending the way that they say it is, especially in some of the communities across Texas. But Keith, something you spotted early on, and Aaron, I remember getting an email from you as well on this, which is, what about all the deferred biopsies and checkups?
Yeah.
So Keith, do you think that it's fair to say that we might see an increase in the death rate dramatically in a couple months?
It's more than fair. We are. There's a letter sent to the president by 600 physicians talking specifically to this point because people are so afraid. If you look at our average number of patients that go to the emergency department for heart disease and strokes, I actually saw an article published that said the coronavirus has reduced the amount of strokes in the country. And I'm thinking, no, it hasn't. It's reduced the amount of people that are going to the hospital with a stroke. And this is where I called it kind of a paradoxical death rate. What you're seeing is, or morbidity, is you're seeing people with actual sicknesses that are afraid to go and be treated. And hospitals in my community, and I've talked to friends of mine all over the country, you're seeing anywhere from 40 to 60% of hospital workers furloughed. Most ICUs are they're putting nurses on call. They're sending them home. And this is where the problem hits. When we, quote, come out of this, they are not there in case, what if we did have an actual huge influenza and we needed them back? We don't have them there.
So what about, and this is something that I'm perplexed about. What if, what about the people that are afraid to go into a hospital because they've been told that it's not safe?
They've been conditioned. Yeah.
They're missing a biopsy. What if there's a preventable tumor that's not being found?
Mm. Yeah, there. If you
is the death rate going up or down? And that's something I'm interested in.
I would say the best place if you want to answer this question is because the countries in Europe are way over their infection curve, and the data is much more mature. Is that the UK actually has fantastic data on this? You can go to two different people.
Stop complimenting these NHS far left.
Knows the data, not the hospital system.
They do not have a superior
medical system. It's called the OHS is the name of the organization that does this. And also Dr. Spiegelhalter from Cambridge and Dr. Sakura. So both of them have talked about this actual exact question of like, what is the secondary effects of the lockdown? And Dr. Sakura, who used to be the head doctor for cancer for WHO for a number of years, runs a cancer hospital in England, is dramatically, like, I mean, dramatically maybe even an understatement of what he's seeing in terms of the patients showing up, the lack of people coming in, they're coming in too late, and the sort of the ripple effects that happened of the lockdown going to us for like 1 or 2 years. And Spiegelhalter has also shown that like England is going to reach the point where he believes that the number of excess fatalities that are actually happening in England are going to be of the secondary effects, not of the primary effect, which is COVID, right? So more people in England now will soon be dying of the secondary effects of the lockdown.
Well, I told you this in March. I said the effects, in a year, we're not going to be talking about the deaths from coronavirus. I mean, we're going to be talking about the response for that for generations, and we're going to be seeing for the next decade the effects because we're seeing a lot of people that are slowly showing up with later stage cancers. I mean, if you look at just people that get colonoscopies, people that get breast biopsies, people that get cardiac exams, stress tests, things like that, no one was getting those. And so we do that so we can catch these diseases early, and we have some places still aren't doing that, and people are scared to come back even when they can. So this is going to cause, I think the mortality and morbidity is going to be staggering.
We're seeing an increase in drug overdoses, suicide, anxiety, alcoholism, depression. Do you have any?
The Lancet did an article on this.
So one is that there was a hospital just released data in California that said they had more people that committed suicide than died of COVID.
I'm sorry, which hospital was this?
I believe it was in Sherman Oaks.
Sherman Oaks, which is Ventura County.
Is either Sherman Oaks or somewhere. There's another Oaks in the Bay Area.
They have Thousand Oaks.
Yeah, I think it's one of the Oaks. Like,
Thousand Oaks and Sherman Oaks.
Yeah, right one, it was a hospital.
Right near Westlake Village and
so the, Ventura County. There are two studies that have actually been done in the UK, or sorry, in the UK, in Europe, that I find out very persuasive. So one is a study of the Swiss population that they estimated the total number of people that have a shortened life due to shutdowns would be almost 180,000 to 200,000 Swiss. Versus the number of people that died.
There's only 6 million Swiss.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Swiss to begin with.
There was a study in Austria by a number of oncologists that said that that more people that they theorize will die that died of these elective surgeries than ever died of COVID on a per week basis.
But to your point on the drug overdoses and the suicides, there were two studies done. One was done by The Lancet, and these are proven studies. And these studies showed with the data that you saw a 3% increase in drug overdose deaths because when people aren't allowed to go out during a shutdown type period, and you see a 1% increase in suicides.
Well, and
that adds up.
Getting in shape doesn't have to be about losing a specific amount of weight or a magic number on the scale. It's about building healthier habits and feeling better about yourself. If fitting into that favorite pair of jeans is your goal, great. But there are many reasons you might want to practice self-care, and every person is different. You might want to be able to run a marathon. You might just want to lose 10 or 15 pounds. Noom, N-O-O-M, is the way to do that because everyone is different. Noom adjusts your lifestyle. They teach you psychology behind the decisions you make, and then help you keep track of everything from workouts and steps to analyzing your diet and recommending healthy recipes. Noom also connects you with a personally assigned goal specialist and a community of other Noomers. So you have all the support you need to empower your change. There's physical, psychological, and social ways to get this done. Better self-care, feeling confident in clothing, more energy, or just an overall better feel about yourself. You can integrate Noom into your life. You trust yourself to make good choices. There's specific lessons you learned about psychology or habits. These of just 10 minutes a day. They will help you get your goals done. Noom is the habit-changing solution that helps users learn to develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. It's based in psychology. Noom teaches you why you do the things you do and empowers you with the tools you need to break bad habits and replace them with better ones. No food is good or bad or off limits. Noom teaches moderation and can be used in conjunction with many pre-existing popular diets if you want. Noom doesn't tell you what to do and what not to do. It teaches you how to look inside your own mind and make better decisions for yourself. Chat with your goal specialist and Noom community to get and give help to people going through the same things. You don't have to change it all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your trial today. Noom.com/Charlie. Noom.com/Charlie. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/Charlie to start your free trial today. That's Noom.com/Charlie.
So I want to be very specific about our language here, and both of you are, and I talk about this on the podcast, and there's a podcast coming out tomorrow where I mention it. And Dennis Prager also has been terrific on it, the great Dennis Prager. And it's kind of funny. We independently both came to this, and then I realized he said it, so I want to make sure I give attribution where credit's due, where I was reading an article, and it said, virus responsible for economic ruin. Mm-hmm. So that's funny. I said, I never knew a virus could destroy the economy. And I read it, and then I challenged, and I encourage everyone watching this, read your news, don't watch your news, because you can catch things like that when you're reading and processing your news, because it's a lot easier to spot inconsistencies. I said, the virus didn't do this. The lockdown did.
Yeah.
It's a completely...
It was our policy response.
And so
but our policy makers, sometimes
the semantic, people say, oh, that's just semantics. That's what the left-wingers who watch our show, thank you, by the way, for upping our numbers. Best day ever, actually, on the Charlie Kirk Show today. They say, oh, that's just semantics. I said, no, it's actually really important. It's super instructive because it didn't have to be this way. And that's to your point, Keith.
Right. This is a true man-made disaster. Mm-hmm. And specifically the response, like I told you, people are not going to be talking about the virus in a year. We're going to be talking about this response for generations. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't even know because we've never done this before, the true outcome of this. We're talking about the paradoxical death, things like that, what it's going to be long term. Mm-hmm. We don't know, Charlie, because we've never done it.
So Aaron, is it fair to say that we were lied to, misled throughout this process?
In terms of the
shutdown
policies?
The projections, the promises, the extrapolations.
Yeah, I'm more of a Harlan Razor guy, so I never attribute malice to what is just stupidity.
We were talking about
that earlier.
Yeah. Like I try not to project motives on people. I think that game ends in really bad places, and you can I think, avoid true, good, solid data. But I do think that you need to realize that a lot of what's being discussed and masquerading, I think, as science or data is actually just different storytelling and different political approaches designed to make an argument.
And I would make the counter argument, and I agree with you. And I
no, feel free
99%
to
of the time in your camp.
Yeah.
Not I don't know the motives, but I do look at I believe in history and experience. I'm a lot older than both of you, so I've been
in many operating rooms.
I worked overseas for a long time. Yeah. I've seen a lot, and what I see is that Dr. Fauci, in particular, has been at the CDC or the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease for a long period of time. And when you have someone in a medical position that should be looking at science, but he's in a bureaucracy. And he controls the mechanisms of funding for studies. And you wonder where, when you stop seeking truth and you start seeking power, I don't know whether he's doing that or not, but I can tell you that I don't see him seeking truth in this based on his previous reaction in prior times, pandemics, however you want to say
it. But here's a question for today.
Okay.
Keith, you told me in late February, this virus is here longer than we realize. Lockdowns will not work. Here's the only path forward. And you've been proven correct on every single point you told me. Aaron, you wrote publicly in mid-March and had it taken down in Medium about everything that was wrong and just being skeptical and being an empiricist and everything that's correct. I have a question, though. What are we being misled about today? Because they're not done. This is not
– No.
In some ways, I want to correct some of the tone of this conversation. So it feels as if this is over. There are Americans living in shutdown right now.
Right. And that's what I would tell them. One, I think as a physician and other physicians are coming out and speaking, but not enough. And again, when I talk about bureaucracies, there's a lot of bureaucratic organizations involved in medicine that, again, when you look to gain power and not truth, they can't coexist. So I would tell people the truth is we have a lot more information now, and none of the information that is coming out, none, zero support.
Lockdowns. So that's a good takeaway. Lockdowns don't work. Is that a fair scientific takeaway?
Absolutely. Not only is it fair scientific, they've never worked because we've never done them. And there's a reason why we've never done them. In fact, Johns Hopkins just back in 2006 said it would be, quote, a catastrophe to do something like that.
I would say that there's a lot of misdirection around primary school age children. That is very, you know, I'm a very strong pro school choice guy. But I recognize the damage that happens in terms of when you don't have access to public school, when you disrupt a family's life that way. And just as an example for the Kawasaki disease, which was sort of a hot minute.
What is this? I've heard three people mention this in the last
couple like,
days.
So there's a number of pediatricians I talked to who've been all around the country as I've been doing my data sheets and projects. And like essentially, it's the best way to describe it is like it's an allergic response to a virus. And it was misleading, I think, to say could like it works one way, does not work the other. Is Kawasaki only related to COVID? No. Could you get a Kawasaki type response from COVID? Yes. And you just I think more or less that has now kind of moved aside as an issue because a ton of physicians in the UK and also in Europe said that this is not related to COVID. That just happens. Like we don't know why it happens, right? It's just like an autoimmune response.
And there's no hard data that links this to COVID at all. And if you look back, again, when you can pick and choose the data you want to use to get to the point where you want to go, then I think it becomes dangerous. And it becomes dangerous to a society. But when you have intellectually honest people, scientists, doctors that – and I love the way Aaron approaches things because he literally looks at every side based on the data.
Yeah, like there was a description of an Italian paper said measuring a new outbreak of Kawasaki disease. Well, how can a non-transmittable disease go through an outbreak? Right? Like there's all these like things that like – and these are very smart, like, you know, I think very well-intentioned people.
So, yeah, I want to get into that because this is super important, Aaron. Yeah. So you call – I had a conversation with you where I was really upset in March over just a shutdown.
I think we were all upset about it.
Yeah, but not everyone.
I remember a lot of joy in March.
There were people that were afraid.
Yeah. I want to return to
I was more angry than I was afraid. Let me be very clear. I was – my anger superseded my fear throughout this entire process. And you said, Charlie, you don't understand. When you look at these models, anyone who understands statistics – they just fall apart immediately. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Because the assumptions that go into the models, once you like look at the base understanding of like, well, how does this a SIR model work, or how like what are your underlying asymptomatic assumptions, or what's your underlying fatality assumptions? That's actually when you get presented a model. That's the things that politicians should actually ask. What is your underlying fatality rate? What is your underlying assumptions in terms of how many in your model, how many people are actually coming encounter with each other, right? Are you doing any adjustments for age? Are you doing any adjustments for, let's say, location? Are you
Can I just play skeptic here? How is it possible that these experts didn't do this, Aaron? This is a legitimate question, and I'm in your camp here, but these are allegedly the smartest people on the planet that have given so much power, and it's not an insignificant sum that had the attention on this, right? So it's not that. Why are there not 200,000 Aarons? So do you understand the question?
No,
the entire world population was focused on this. It wasn't just a statistical model around an outcome of a football game.
But it was a scary moment, right? Because people looked at Lombardi and they looked at Wuhan and they're like, well, you know, we have to default to credentialism, and I just don't have that.
But
that's
a logical
fallacy.
But it is a logical fallacy, argument from authority.
No, I agree.
And
I
so, but build this out for me, Aaron. There's the smartest statisticians and the alleged most intelligent people. They were wrong. Mm-hmm. How is that possible?
Well, like, so what I would say is that the overwhelming emotion, the fear, the hysteria silenced so many people that, like, as an example, there's one of the most well-known coronavirus experts in Hong Kong. His name is Dr. Nichols. He said very early on that he was predicting that it was going to be no more serious than a normal flu. No one paid attention to him. Or Dr. Altwater at Johns Hopkins, he basically said the same thing. Like, there were a number of people that were, like, originally skeptical that essentially were pushed out because of the momentum behind the sort of situation we got into. And a lot of that was driven by the media. A lot of that was driven by, I would say, like, politicians that had other goals.
I think the way you can describe it is you have a lot of these modelers that were almost fanatics about their modeling and wrapping themselves in invincible ignorance.
Yeah, like they were presenting it from a skeptical perspective,
right,
which is how you should do it.
Right.
As
there was a real lack of humility and a lack of doubt.
The best way I could describe this is if we go back to the Enlightenment, Descartes used to say, I think, therefore I am. And that was his famous – it was the beginning of the Enlightenment. He said, wow, your being is your capacity to think. This is the death of Descartes in the beginning of this bizarre sophistry of just saying things that somewhat make sense. – You commented on this previously. I want to give you the chance to comment on it. But, Aaron, I find it either beyond flummoxing, so disheartening and disappointing that there wasn't more of you.
But this is the job of politicians, right?
It's the job of the modelers, though. It's the job of the scientists.
No, like,
politicians, their job is to exploit us, and we have to limit their ability to do that.
But a politician,
it's not their job. It's what they do. Their job should be to protect our freedom.
Yes, yes.
But a politician, historically, a real dyed-in-the-wool politician is out to gain power. And a dyed-in-the-wool scientist doctor is out to seek truth. And again, truth and power can't coexist. And to the sophist point, a politician, especially a lot lately, have decided this is what our truth is. This is a model. This is our truth. And we are going to tell you it. We're going to scare you. We're going to say it over and over again till you believe it. And that's the sophist bent. And they don't have, I'm sorry, the intellectual honesty or the integrity, because they are more concerned with their power and being right.
I believe that, and maybe we won't come to an answer on this, but it's amazing to me that in the entire world population, there are tens of thousands of people that have the capacity to reason and to think in that level. And the amount of dissenting voices was incredible. And Aaron, you deserve such credit because you were just not a dissenting voice. You were a vocal and repeated and doubling down and tripling down voice.
But
you traded on all the credibility of your name. And now you can actually say, you should write the book, Why I Was Right and Everyone Else Was Wrong.
No, I don't.
You won't do it because you're a humble gentleman.
But I'll write it for you.
There's a history of Dr. Fauci and the bureaucracy going after people that dissent, going after people that actually stood up.
So now let's go that level deeper. Were there other malevolent forces at play here, Keith? Because I'm getting so many people ask me this question, and I just say, I don't know. I can't answer it. Without getting into bizarro fringe theories and all that stuff, let's just stick with facts and reason and logic like we do. But were there other malevolent forces at play?
There are several books that have been written about folks that have worked with Dr. Fauci. and that have had their research squashed and actually just been run out. The most recent was a lady that just her gag order or whatever, her non-disclosure ran out, and she's been very public about it, and she's been very specific and detailed about it. And when you look at, again, like Aaron talks about data, when you take what we hear and then what we see, and then you look back at the tapes of Dr. Fauci and others talking about one response during one period and a different response during another, and then you look at the actual science and history of medicine when we haven't done something and while we're doing something. So none of it makes sense. Then it has to be some undertone.
I have to ask about this, Keith. I got a lot of emails and messages about the individual you're talking about. And some people that I respect say she's totally discredited. Her name's Miskovitz or something. I've never gotten so much incoming on a certain topic outside of Fauci and these other things on that topic. And I just take a neutral position and say, let's let the facts. Can you add? Because our base and our viewers right now, and our numbers are great right now, praise God, they're listening to you, Keith. Tell us what you know.
I don't know her, but I know other people that have worked with Dr. Fauci. And I know other people that work in the government that had worked around him. And this is not a new – now, I don't have any personal experience with Dr. Fauci. But people that I respect and have worked with and I believe have integrity have told me – I remember one guy calling me, and he was just really upset. And his first comment was, Dr. Fauci is not serving the president well. And he didn't mean it in an ugly way. He has immense respect for our president. He wasn't banging on Dr. Fauci saying he's a bad person. He's seen what he's doing, and he's saying he's not serving the president well. So, again, when you make a when you put it all together, there is a lot of smoke, and there is a lot of
so there's people that said, and her name is Judy Miskovitz, and she's getting I apologize if I mispronounced it. She's getting a lot of attention and a lot of viral traction. And please leave comments, by the way, in the Facebook feed or YouTube feed. We're watching those comments. Please continue to do that. So thank you. And you guys can email your questions in freedom@charliekirk.com. Keith, is there something to this idea that Dr. Fauci had a less than desirable outcome in the HIV AIDS epidemic?
I think there's a lot. I don't have it in front of me. I can look it up, but there's a guy that wrote a book on this, and it was very interesting. And there's a lot of folks that I respect in the scientific community that say yes. I don't have enough detailed information, unless I go back to my notes, to speak on it intelligently. But I can tell you that there are a lot of people that weren't happy with what he did, and the way they describe it makes sense in the fact that Dr. Fauci is part of a bureaucracy. He's also someone who. In the bureaucracy, a politician does not win or cannot stay if he's wrong. And in science, you're going to be wrong a lot till you're right. There should be a lot of doubt cast. So I think more important than this, Charlie, is to separate the science from the bureaucracy. Mm. We need to stop having the folks that are in the bureaucracy that are scientists control the grants.
So it's a dark chapter in the Catholic Church with scholasticism. When Galileo came up with the heliocentric theory of the sun and in the earth, and he said, I think the sun might be something we're revolving around, at the trial of Galileo. And what I'm saying here, I'm trying to complete the point, though, is that what's happening now?
To your point of Galileo, there's a famous drawing of Galileo in his prison cell, and he has the entire universe drawn at the bottom of the prison cell, did it like in chalk, and he's standing there. And people are looking down. There's bars on the wall. They're looking down. And so everyone came to see him. And the sun's coming through and hitting it right where it is. So it kind of has a forward as Galileo was right, but he was thrown in prison because he scared people.
So – and Socrates was also killed by the state for spreading truth. Yeah. It's interesting of how that pattern sometimes repeats itself. Do you owe money for student loan debt? Are you being crushed by the cartel of the colleges? Do you have a grandson, granddaughter, son or daughter that do not know what they are going to do with their student loan debt? It's just keeping them up at night. Well, guess what? There is a path forward. It's called Credible.com. It's an online marketplace that gets you pre-qualified student loan refinancing rates from up to 10 different lenders. They are a shopping market to get you out of debt. They help people get out of student loan debt, and if you've got student loan debt, you could benefit. With a lower rate, you could save on interest and lower your monthly payment. It's cash in your pocket, money in your pocket. With a shorter loan term, you could get
debt-free faster. Consolidate all your student loan bills in one place. Credible customers have given awesome reviews about how much better their lives have been after refinancing their student loans. On Credible, you see actual pre-qualified rates from up to 10 different lenders, whereas with some other marketplaces, you only get a range of rates or ballpark estimates. Guess what? It only takes a couple minutes to check rates. You can get a student loan debt. Again, if you have student loan debt, why are you not going to Credible.com? It's the way to get out. Checking rates does not impact your credit. They'll never sell your data, so you won't receive spam and phone calls from dozens of lenders. So please visit Credible.com/Charlie. That's Credible.com/Charlie. When you refinance your student loans, using this link, they'll give you a $200 gift card. That's Credible.com/Charlie. Credible.com/Charlie. Keith, we know there's a deep state. And I'm going to connect two pieces of recent events here, coronavirus and the 302s with Michael Flynn and the entrapment of Michael Flynn, where it was law entrapment, not law enforcement. And this is not – conspiracy is not a theory. It's a crime. They went after the president. But I want to keep it within the COVID-19 right. China virus conversation here, which is, Keith, is there a medical deep state?
I would say that there's a lot of evidence that there's a medical deep state. I think the deep state is, and you know how I feel about this, is the bureaucracy.
Well, what
and
I'm saying is that we know there's a deep state in the intelligence community. We know there's a deep state in every single aspect of government. Is the government
– i.e. the bureaucracy, yes.
Right. Is the government medical, let's just say, infrastructure, are they immune to that, to use a pun?
No, they're not immune to it. In fact – it's not more concerning, but it's as concerning because these folks control the levers of funding for different research and projects. So they can actually direct the amount of money that goes to certain research. And if they approach it from a sophistic standpoint and decide what they want to get to.
What Keith means by that, I'm sorry to interrupt, sure. Keith, but mm-hmm. just to build it out, in Greek times, a sophist was someone that would make provocative, somewhat true statements – but actually have a fallacious argumentation position, someone that was very good at argumentation but represented something that was factually untrue.
Right.
I just want to make sure our audience understands that.
Do is now they have the ability to fund and they know how – you know how onerous it is to get a grant from the government and they know how to do it. They are the ones that award these grants and so that they can pick and choose winners and losers based on the money that they award. And they can also, from their position – they can discredit people, whether this lady was discredited for good reasons or not. I tend to believe what she's saying based on other experiences.
And what is she saying?
She's saying that she was targeted for speaking the truth, that she was she was actually put in jail but never charged. She was, you know.
By whom? By
Dr. Fauci and those of the deep state. And you could look at this and go, really, put in jail and never charged? But then – you know, who would think that a decorated general would be targeted by the FBI based on the 302s changed?
And I mean,
there's some corollary here, like you said.
I want to ask Aaron in just 1 second about a very specific corollary of that tangent. But I have to ask because we're getting so many comments right now and emails. I want to be very fact driven. Bill and Melinda Gates, is there something there or is this just.
Again, if we're just going to talk about the facts, the first models in the U.S. were based off of IH.
That wasn't the first. That was –
well, the ones that they were using.
Yeah, Dr. Murray and his crew at University of Washington. That was.
Are they funded by Gates or are they?
$375 million grant.
Oh, really?
The models, it started with IH, and I'm sorry I had this written down, but –
IHME, yeah. Institute for Health Medical Metrics.
That's it.
Yeah.
There is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funded that. And if you look at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, these foundations, these 501c3s, in conjunction with our tax dollars and grants, seem to fund a lot of the modeling. And a lot of this modeling is not just for infectious diseases and viruses, but can also be used for climate change models and other science.
There's a perfect segue to what I wanted to ask Aaron. So Aaron, we deal with a lot of modeling that seems to be incorrect. One of the reasons I was skeptical from the get-go is I'm inherently anti-hysteria. I think hysteria is usually not guided by reason. Not always the case. I think hysteria after 9/11 was a reasonable response because our country was attacked by
foreign actors that wanted to destroy our country. So I don't think hysteria is necessarily always unreasonable. I think it should be reserved. But when you have cycles of hysteria and repeated hysteria, that's nothing more than a tactic. Mm-hmm. And so we had hysteria when Trump ran for office. We had hysteria when Trump won the presidency. We have hysteria when Trump was in transition. Hysteria saying that Trump was going to declare war on North Korea, crash the economy, crash the stock market, cause a civil war,
nuclear.
All these sorts of things. Yes. Climate change modeling has been wrong now for decades. And so that's why from the outset I was just – there's something not right here. Mm-hmm. And it's just something you know within your own consciousness and your own purview. Aaron, explain to us how this modeling works and how they're able – how these people are still able to have credibility after they're wrong so often.
Well it's –
because I mean, you're in the weeds on the modeling.
Yeah, like it's hard to say because, like, I mean, in one respect, like, when you are building a model, you're trying to project the future. And it's just that when it – so, like, just like an economist, right, trying to predict where GDP is going, where unemployment rate's going. But for some reason, when it came to this type of modeling, we did not treat it as an hypothesis. We treat it as truth, and I think it was because, you know, we think this is people's lives, right? And we didn't have the proper, I think, skeptical framework built into our public policy framework to allow us to, one, ask questions, or two, even having our representatives in government to actually have permission to ask questions.
And I think here's what's so dangerous, Aaron, is that we have fallen – almost been hypnotized. It's been hypnotic. 97% of scientists believe in this explanation for climate change. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if science is a democracy. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that we applied this shaky science?
Yeah, like it's
to this hysteria.
It's the whole like consensus framework type of thinking.
What does that mean? Build that out.
Which is in the sense of like as if that matters, right? As if a bunch of people who had the same, you know, PhDs, et cetera, all say something, and you're like, well, but even the example of that climate change, when you actually look into that number, there's a wide range of opinions about what that actually even means, right, for that specific 97%. So, but even for this situation, in terms of the epidemiologic models that were being presented for COVID, I would even say it's not even that high, that there was a large number of people that are saying, why are we accepting IHME? Why are we accepting Imperial College? Some of the sort of top modelers, you could say, in terms of infectious disease in America, did not agree with the University of Washington model because the University of Washington model is actually not based on a traditional infectious disease modeling. It's actually based on something completely different.
Everyone had a question about that, but I think more to the point is just because you're an expert or just because you're good at science or whatever doesn't make you wise. Knowledge doesn't equal wisdom. Our founders didn't talk about you've got to have the smartest guys leading you. They said you had to have principles and virtue, and mm-hmm. you had to have wisdom. And so when the bureaucracy grew so big and the modelers become, you know, these modelers are the ones that are getting the funding. They're the ones that are getting the airtime. And when I mentioned to you about unrestricted warfare and the Chinese, part of their strategy is they had to co-opt the media to push their strategy. And mm-hmm. I don't think that was a big push for them here. The media followed right along. You can't blow the wind on this fire and get it this hot without a media constantly pushing those flames.
But on the point about like how did we post sort of, I think it was like March 26th or 27th is when Dr. Birx started talking about using Murray's model from the University of Washington. There were a number of modelers that came out that we were, let's say, advising before from University of Columbia and Harvard that said that, and I quote, this model has no basis in epidemiology, which is like in some respects, like I've watched several interviews with Dr. Murray, and I actually do sympathize with what he was trying to do because he saw the failure of the Imperial College model and he wanted to try to do something different. So you can think of like the perspective of like the Imperial College model was like you could say top down. It was looking at case data and looking down at fatality data. And the IHME model was looking at it from bottom up, right? Which is why hospitalization rates were so important to that model versus like the actual projections as they were presented in Imperial College was something different. So like the University of Washington was trying to, I think, attempt to do an iteration in terms of improvement. However, the problem is that I don't believe it's actually a fair modeling technique if you constantly update your model every day.
And they didn't release the code.
I just want to make this very clear because I have not heard anyone explain this. And I think you could really add some insight here and some color to this, Aaron, that would be so helpful, which is
the modeling that they were putting on these charts, the up and down, the parabolas, right? Basically, more or less.
Yeah, the Gaussian principle, yes.
Sure,
the up and down.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but what you're trying to say is that there's a sophisticated code that goes into these.
Yes.
Okay. And so it's not just some – no, I mean, this is a very important conversation.
Right.
Yeah. They only
needed
published outputs. Yeah.
Let's go a level deeper. This is beyond just the 5 minutes that's going to happen on a cable television show. Right. Let's go deeper to this because it's really important. So you have different models published by different epidemiological communities.
Yep.
Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm.
Medical communities.
Yep.
And they have different input variables,
yes.
Right? And so – but that input – all those input variables will end up being some form of a code that they put into a what do they put it into? A computer, obviously, of some sort, right?
Yeah, like Python or something.
Okay.
Like
so
that.
Okay, so usually on universities, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So – but you're trying to say that those codes weren't published?
No.
They were not made public?
No. Only I've only seen one or two models. I mean, Imperial College is one. They finally published it.
Which is why they've been discredited so
much. Yeah. So – and I mean, I've actually done FOIA requests with people of different states to actually get the code. And then you actually find out that a lot of these states didn't even have a model. I've gotten responses they never model.
Can you explain that?
So I've gotten responses in terms of why – because my question was like, can you show me the model to justify continued shelter in place? I've gotten CNN articles. I've gotten –
Wait, who are you asking?
Public health people in various states. Like I email them.
Can you give an example?
Like in Colorado. So like – but I'm not going to out
the – but they're reopening finally in Colorado, right?
I mean, yeah. I want Polis. But yeah, Polis has actually been pretty good on a lot of stuff. So in terms of – and I've been asking for, well, can you give me the actual like files as in the code files so I can run on my computer? So this has actually been a movement among – I mean my skill set's mainly in technology among even pro and anti-lockdown folks that all basically the technology folks – because we have nothing kind of to do right now, we all consensusly agree that in terms of future models, the code should always be public. I should be able to run the model. I should be able to change the inputs so I can see different frameworks. We still have even for the example, just briefly, like on we have quotes from Harvard and Columbia, which are sort of the two centers that have a lot of modeling background. They've been interfacing with the White House. For the model that was actually presented at the Rose Garden that for the 2.2, we still don't actually have – We don't have that. Like, we don't even know where it came from, right? We assume
which model is this?
This was the 2.2 million. If there were no pharmaceutical inventions, and like, I still don't know. We don't really know. It seems like an amalgamation of Imperial College and IHME, but we still don't actually know what all that.
What models are they using now?
We don't know actually.
Well, that's why actual epidemiologists were going crazy, is because they were using a really bad model, and then they used another really bad model. Didn't matter what the starting point was.
Mm-hmm.
There was no cohesiveness in it. There wasn't any understanding of the variables and what they were actually modeling and looking at other than their outcomes.
Yeah.
So Aaron, though, what you're trying to tell me is the people, mostly on the left, that argue for democracy and transparency, they wouldn't democratize the coding process?
I mean, I don't know the political persuasions of the – I mean, I'm guessing
I'm saying that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be concerned when the code is not public because, as we've seen with Imperial College, that it is probably one of the most disastrous examples of you could say, buggy code, right?
Or malfeasance.
How many input variables would a code have? Thousands, tens of thousands.
I mean, it depends on how. Like for the IHME, I mean, they actually have a lot of variables. Like they're even including like mobility data from Apple and Google to do their social distancing frameworks. So like there could be lots of variables. We don't even know.
What's the cost if you get these models wrong?
Well, I mean, could be in terms of Imperial College, it was significant.
Well,
so.
Besides public pressure costs and lack of credibility, but
I mean to SAGE, which is the UK sort of body, just like I don't remember Prince's name of his task force, Corona Task Force, something, right? So SAGE is like that for the UK, and they had a number of models that were inputted in terms of recommending for Downing 10 in terms of like what comes next. And you know, Ferguson's model was the primary model which they were leaning on, and there was an initial request to receive this model publicly. I think it was very late March, like March 24th-ish range, after he did the updated paper on the 23rd, and he just released the code like I think 2 weeks ago, and it was not the original code. I mean, we actually don't even have
the original code.
Yeah, we actually don't even have that. When he gave out. Is more of an abstracted layer from the code. So it's not even really the still even the actual thing we need. And even that we saw there were significant problems with that. But thankfully, this is like, you know, this is a huge scandal in the UK. I mean, the Telegraph, Daily Mail, everyone's reporting
they're all
it.
Over.
They're yeah. finally doing some honest journalism.
Yeah. So for here, I would love to see. I would love to see sort of the justification behind a lot of these assumptions, and we know that they use lots of models. Like I think Newsom has like 4 or 6 he's using.
But what are they?
We don't really know.
Wait, so you're trying to tell me that the governor of the largest state in the country, 40 million people, mm-hmm. with the 6th largest economy on the planet, mm-hmm. more or less 6th or 7th largest
yeah.
economy on the planet,
yeah, yeah.
has 4 or 6 private models of which we don't have the code that is making mm-hmm. that is informing his decision making that has now been publicly debunked based on the information provided?
Well, I mean, I'm not even actually, there's a great moment in like news broadcasting where like there was a local two local stations, right, were discussing the models. This was like maybe like a month ago in California, and they did not know in terms of like this was like the official state, like what was happening in the state, what was projected. And the news anchors did not know there actually were 2 different models. So there was one guy from the state saying something completely different and another guy saying something completely different, right? And I mean, I don't know which models they were citing, but generally speaking, the IHME was the most prolifically used model across America. Now it's less so because they're...
The Imperial one?
No. IHME is the University of Washington.
Okay.
University of Washington.
Which has yeah. also been debunked and has also been funded
by Bill and
Melinda. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, like... I would say that they were – I mean they openly admitted and that they were wrong about hospitalization rates and mobility rate, which is like very large assumptions. And I think the infection fatality rate they assume is like 0.4 to 0.5. Imperial College assumed 0.9.
What is the mortality rate that we know
today? I mean it depends on the population. Right. But I mean generally we're looking – I mean
– It keeps trending downward.
Yeah, that's true. And that's true of all epidemics, right?
It's right. Like
it's called Farr's Law. Farr's Theory.
Farr's Law is about like that –
But eventually it hits an apex though.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
And that was that factored in?
Actually, yeah. I mean, most of the models assume some form of Farr's Law like behavior.
But created it basically in mm-hmm. their assumptions instead of looking at
they baked it in.
It's a projection. It's an assumption about how this right. would behave. And like if you look at past other, you know, coronaviruses like outbreak, they generally behave
But to put it in context, I mean, seriously, models like on climate change. Mm-hmm. I have a home up in Northwest Montana and near Glacier National Park. And so when you go to the park this past year, they had this sign forever that said the glaciers will melt in 2020. That was based on their modeling. Mm-hmm. So they got it wrong.
Yeah.
But all they have to do is change the sign. Mm-hmm. This is much different. Mm-hmm. They got it wrong, and we have an economy that's an extremist. We have actual real tragedies, morbidity happening that have nothing to do with the virus.
One of the things I think is one of the very valid critiques that I think going forward, thinking about like what's next, that like every person who's in a public policy making role should include is at what cost, right? So a lot of these models that are presented in terms of only looking at the virus, we know data, as you just listened earlier, about the secondary effects of a lockdown, from like increasing unemployment to other underlying pathologies caused from economic distress. And almost all these models don't include that. Right. They don't. I mean, you could actually just do something like a separate model that actually includes that and not necessarily put it together. But the fact that like we there are interviews of these like pro lockdown, you know, folks that are modelers, and people have actually asked them, well, have you modeled the economic costs? And they say no.
But the
data is there.
But, you know, they're
modelers,
they do what they're asked to do. And that's why we have elected officials. That's what I was talking about where I said knowledge doesn't necessarily equate to wisdom.
Well, but mm-hmm. no one voted for Anthony Fauci.
Exactly. The people that. And so while Fauci was – while he's standing up there telling us when we can go back to school or work, or we're going to have to wait for a disease – I mean for a vaccine or for us to really understand the disease. And we're getting a lot of are you going to believe me or your lying eyes kind of stuff now.
So Aaron, did anyone get the modeling right?
The answer is no, but it's not no in the sense of like – let me see. How can I be specific? Like –
Different variations of wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean,
from really bad to just
catastrophic to almost destroying your country.
Yeah, but I mean, again, the policy is different from the model. But like I think that, I mean, projections are just projections. Like, I mean, as you update them, they change, et cetera. But what I think the proper way of seeing modeling. Is, you know, because we don't want to. I don't want to discourage modeling at all. But it should be presented into what is the assumptions, at what cost, and tell me how you think you're wrong.
But
right?
I can answer the question.
Yes,
I can answer
exactly.
the question
Just
though.
Just be transparent.
There's been some modeling that has been correct. The modeling that you all three of us said that suicides will go up, that modeling was correct. I didn't need some Python computer in the University of Washington to tell me that. Mm-hmm. The modeling that 36 million people will go out of work, that alcoholism will increase, that marijuana usage will increase. Yeah. Aaron, should we ever trust these modelers again?
Yes. I mean, but
you think we should trust these
people? Not these, but modelers.
Yes. Like you have to put this. Like, I don't want to throw the baby out of the bathwater. Right? Viruses are real. They kill people. We need to use science. We need to use our medicine.
But they didn't use science.
But you're going to have to back up on this to look at again. To the point is, you have to do your models from a scientific method and be very transparent.
But are models even instructive?
Yeah, they are. I think they are. Yeah, I think they are.
If they're done.
But this one did more harm than good.
And they should be updated, too. They should be changed.
But here's my question. It's a provocative one. Dennis Prager says this is the worst decision, probably, conscious decision we made, non-military decision.
Yeah, he's
decision.
Told me that, yeah.
Well, I agree with you.
It's the worst decision in American history, non-military decision. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. And so if we had no models, we would have avoided that decision. So why should we ever trust modeling again? Make the case for why we should trust these expert models.
Because like we need to understand in terms of when a new virus happens, people that make policy, people that we vote on, should understand the different ramifications of different decisions. It doesn't mean that they'll happen, but you should, let's say, in this framework, in this assumption, here's what we think could happen, right? But I think the failure of the modeling was what you said, Keith, in terms of like being presented as overly certain about something that they shouldn't be. So as long as models are presented from a skeptical perspective, what is your assumption?
So you would say in the current form, but yes in the actual.
But I think this is systemic failure. It's systemic failure from a physician side, from a modeler side, mm-hmm. from an epidemiological bureaucrat side, not from a lot of the folks out there that recognize this was wrong. And again, they weren't serving the president well. They weren't giving him the data that he needed.
No, but this is a broader question I have here. So if certain people say this is the worst decision, I'm not saying that. I'm just quoting what Dennis Prager has said. Let's just take Dennis Prager's lead.
I'll just tell you, I agree with it.
You agree with it. Okay, absolutely. So that's Keith's position. I don't know. I'm in the middle. I think I could see it both ways. So if we had no modeling at all, mm-hmm. we would have avoided that. Correct? Because it was the modeling that was the reason we shut down our economy. What I'm saying is if we shut down the modeling industry, what would happen?
Well, it's not just the modeling. We didn't look at anything besides the modeling. We didn't update it. So if you just want to say the modeling, you have to define what the modeling is.
I'm talking about the XY axis on the chart where they said this many people are going to die.
Right. But then you have to look at the model compared to historically and experience and actual what we know throughout the history of medicine. And when the models are so far outpaced from reality, I mean, you know, you could say these models, in my opinion, based on history and experience, didn't really reflect reality. They reflected some catastrophic, apocalyptic, doomsday scenario that wasn't, I understand it was a what if, but when what is started happening, no one was adjusting. And then when they made them opaque, not publishing code, not explaining the variables, when people try to hide what they're doing and you're making these kind of decisions that are really life altering. So modeling's important. Both of you are right.
I'm just asking the question. Yeah. That's not necessarily my position. I want to make it very clear for Media Matters watching this because they got nothing else to do. I am not advocating for the abolition of the modeling industry. Mm-hmm. I'm asking a thought-provoking question that I want to hear defense of these people that almost destroyed our country.
Go ahead.
I'll just tell you, it has to do with the integrity of the people modeling. And I know that sounds kind of trite, but it's true in science and everything else. So one of the biggest problems we have now is a lot of scientific data comes out, and a lot, even in medical peer review, that's just
Here's the problem, though, here, guys, and I would love to hear Aaron respond to this. You agree with the presupposition that the postmodernists don't even view science as an objective exercise. The postmodernists,
that is true. That's what postmodern believes.
Right, so they view it as a power exercise. Mm-hmm. Right, they don't believe in Newtonian physics. They don't believe in the laws of thermodynamics.
They don't believe in absolute truth.
They just don't believe in empiricism. It's this Jacques Derrida, who's disastrous force of catastrophe on Western society. Mm-hmm. So, if you have postmodernists running your society, why should we assume that science is going to be impartial? Therefore, why should we ever trust models again?
But numbers can be analyzed, right? So like even if you are as when I look at papers and I look at things that are being if you ask the right questions, you can see the assumptions go into it. And I would say, like, one area I do think that basic, you know, SIR type of infection modeling should improve is essentially, you know, to use a phrase of, like, it needs a behavioral economist revolution, right? We need to actually build a type of infectious disease modeling that actually understands and mimics how people behave.
But you're, right? What you're saying is whoever's doing the modeling can't be part of the postmodernist movement.
Yeah, well, look.
I wasn't even – yeah.
I think more broadly, I think Aaron has been – you see, the solution is if you're going to publish a law that will be given to a lawmaker, you should by law have to publish – you're going to publish a model. Let me say this. If you're going to publish a model that will be handed to a lawmaker, by law you should have to release the code.
Yeah, yeah. I think any type of public health decision that's being made based on a model that's being presented to the public
– no question.
By definition, right?
Yes. Yeah, it should not hide behind FOIA. It should be public.
Well, and when you – I've published papers in peer-reviewed literature, and when you publish a paper – and you go to a meeting and you present it, and, you know, people will attack your paper. You have to defend it at times, things like that. You also, a lot of times, when people get grants, they go through an institute review board, an IRB, to see is this a good, you know, model or what you want to do or experiment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing right now is we're seeing a lot of things pushed through with no science, not a lot of eyes on it before it comes to publication. And there's not a lot of peer review, and there's we need that too, and we need to have people independent peer review.
Here's where I'm at on this, and then I want to get to some questions, and we have a ton of them. Freedom@charliekirk.com, and this entire conversation will be re-aired on the Charlie Kirk Show, and you have to do what? Type in Charlie Kirk Show, press subscribe. Actually, the link is actually there on the Facebook stream. All you got to do is press that link, guys, and hit subscribe. But here's where I'm at. I distrust the centralization of power definitionally. Right. That's why I'm a conservative, is that I think that the best systems are ones that are decentralized and people-centric and allow for human freedom and human flourishing and private property and individual responsibility. And so when you centralize the entire decision-making process of society so centrally in the – where the authority is so absolute based on a centralized, you know, medical community, by definition, you're going to have this – the worst of human society are going to try to infiltrate and try to impact that. And so I have very little confidence in these people, less confidence ever before. And I'm at a place where I think people need to be held accountable for this, because this was not a victimless crime. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to say it was in violation of any crime that was on the laws. I'm not saying that. But I last weekend I had to go to a ceremony for someone that overdosed on drugs. And it's fair to say – or the reason I asked the question was that person still alive if we didn't shut down the American economy? And so I'm upset. Mm-hmm. And what's going to change because of this, Aaron?
That's a really tough question, because not in the sense of, like, I totally agree with you that, like, I do believe that there should be an investigation and some hearings as going to happen in the UK that they've already basically started talking about, because the ramifications of this decision will be so immense, and the pain is going to get worse as the economic damage continues to flow out. Hopefully, like, we'll be able to recover quickly. And I mean, I also hope that people actually cheer it on instead of continuing to wishing that people will either pass away from the virus or the destruction of our country. Like, believing that this virus will end civilization is, I think, one of the most egregious forms of I would say, like, messaging or manipulation that I just don't believe in. Like, it's you see a lot of that being, like, sort of wrapped together in terms of, like, wishful thinking. Like, I don't understand, like, why don't we celebrate the fact that, like, Georgia didn't end up that way it does, but Florida didn't end up that way.
Can you comment on that super quick? Sorry, Keith, yeah. And then sure. I want to get to you. But how are Georgia and Florida doing?
They're doing fine. Like, I mean, it's great.
Like, why is the media not talking about this?
Because it's embarrassing. Right. And also, like, it's just sort of like, let's move on. Right. And I want us to, going forward, to be much more transparent about how we make the decisions. But also, I believe that we should have reform. We should say that this type of public policy making in terms of healthcare should be restricted, should be held accountable in terms of check and balance with the legislator. Right. I think there's a bill being proposed into the Ohio legislature that says the public health department and the governor has the ability to issue public health orders for 15 days. After the 15 days, it goes to a subcommittee of legislators. I think it's 9 or 7 or something like that. That is something that we should look at. Like, we should look at reforms in this space.
You were going to say something.
Yeah, I would say that this virus, as bad as it's been, has really chummed the waters for the American people. to see what we have in our government and why big government doesn't work. I don't think we have any clearer example of why massive bureaucracy is not only inefficient, but it's deadly. I mean, and that's not hyperbole. That's just what I'm seeing right now. And as American, I mean, we're a constitutional republic. We've survived over 235 years. Next nearest constitutional republic is 17 years. And there's a reason for that. Our founders knew what they were talking about when they put it together. And they said when we elect leaders, we had to look for people with principles and virtue. And we have an election coming up. And we have to pay attention at the ballot box. We need to look at our state and local officials and how they have responded to and what they have responded to or lack of data. And they should be held responsible for their actions, but also their inaction.
That's and, right. You know. So we're going to read off some questions here that were emailed to us at freedom@charliekirk.com. I'll try to make sure we're equitable and both of you can answer them. Keith, I'm really worried about schools reopening in the fall. Is it safe for my child to return to school? Thanks so much.
Yes. And it's safe for your child to return to school because children that have never had to stay home to begin with aren't being shown to cause problems or transmission of the virus. In fact, the more studies that are coming out right now show us that kids are not a major vector of the virus. In fact, it's more important that your child go to school for the health and safety of your child so that he'll build up immunity. I mean, you don't want to keep your – most time when school starts, we always have a run of viruses, colds, and flus in children, and they build up immunity. That's how you keep from having a second round or a worse round or a higher peak the second time when you actually have an influenza pandemic come around. You build up that herd immunity. So – with this virus, we now know that it doesn't affect children significantly, that there's a decreased chance of transmission, and I would send your kid to school and not worry about them. Don't let fear drive your decision because science and data would say send your kid to school.
So here's one for Aaron. Aaron, I'm stuck in California, and they're shutting down our state till July 4th. Do you think this is rational, and what is a good way to defend against it with my liberal neighbors who think we should stay shut down? Thanks so much.
That sucks.
I had an easy one.
Yeah, that's I'm not very hopeful for California personally. But I think that the way that you, if you're thinking about how should you resist lockdowns, the main mode and means at which we have been saved from it has been federalism. That sheriffs are disobeying shelter-in-place orders, city councils, right? So if you look at specifically for California, look at what San Diego is doing. San Diego is reopening, and they're reopening specifically restaurants, I think, today, actually. So you can look at other examples in California, and Newsom has reduced the requirements to reopening significantly, so much so that I believe almost like one-third to two-thirds of the state could actually reopen into phase two almost immediately. I would say that it's encouraging in the sense, one, that Newsom has reduced the sort of requirements for reopening. But if you're in, I guess it sounds like he's in LA County. I don't know what Garcetti's going to do. Although one encouraging sign is that when his public, I forgot her name, who's the head of the public health authority for
the
LA.
The doctor who's not a doctor?
Yeah. So she said it was going to be 3 months. There was significant blowback to where he said,
She's not even a doctor.
I don't know her name.
Well, she's not. She's a doctor in some sort of crazy, bizarre education.
Most people don't graduate from med school and go, boy, I just want to be a county doctor someday.
She earns half a million dollars a year, $500,000.
Wow. Maybe they should be saying, I want to be a county doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
Someday.
There you go.
So I think that you'll see a moderation coming in California, but I don't know when.
So in closing here, guys, any thoughts that we didn't cover, anything you want to share with the audience as we kind of complete it? And then we'll take one or two more questions. I want to make sure you guys get a chance to mention anything you want to plug anything, a book.
I'm a big history guy. And so I don't think a lot of people know this, but our country was founded and part of the Revolutionary War was centered around a virus. And it was around smallpox at that time. And there was a big concern in the Revolutionary Army. George Washington actually was quarantining people that had the virus, but the British soldiers didn't really have it bad because they had been exposed in Britain, and there was a real chance that we were going to lose the war because everyone was getting sick. And Washington initially said, we're going to quarantine, we're not going to inoculate. And then he changed his mind halfway through, and I think it was 1777 in March, and he inoculated the army. And there was a risk, because if you got smallpox, there's a 1 in 3 chance you were going to die. And if he inoculated the army and someone could pass it along, he could have wiped out his entire army. But he took a chance. He changed course, and he took the risk in order to have the chance to fight for freedom. And he again inoculated his army before they fought in the winter the next year. So I think it's real important to see that this is not a new phenomenon, and that we have to make decisions, and there is a risk. But the reward that Washington saw, freedom, and with a much worse virus, was much more important. And I see a lot of freedom being taken away, and I don't see a lot of risk from this virus versus the freedom.
I would say that, I mean, specifically that I've becoming increasingly concerned with freedom of speech and freedom of dissent in this country, and the ability for even academics to disagree. Like, you know, we all are feeling the pains and sort of downstream in terms of culture, like, you know, whether it's irresponsible media writing to removing on platforms, but academia has the same problem, which is like Jonathan Haidt has written lots about heterodox university, and I'm really concerned that if we do not continue to support the ability to people to freely dissent and to freely advocate for their position, that like we will make decisions like we had with lockdowns. That we become so myopic that even we don't even question or even have other experts that disagree in the same room, we can make massive mistakes and then not like sort of create bad public policy that affects millions and millions of people. And in our own country, we're concerned about the secondary pathologies of the shutdown. But I'm a big fan of Africa, and I go there a lot, and I can tell you that we're in. Lots of that continent, what we've done to it is utter disastrous. It's a travesty, and the secondary effects of what's going to happen in Africa because of our own decision will definitely
the shutdowns.
Yeah, the shutdowns.
Oh yeah,
I want to get to this question. It kind of involves Africa, and I have no idea if you guys know anything about this. So I want to get to these two questions because they're the most commented and most liked on the feed. And they can also email us at freedom@charliekirk.com. Can Dr. Keith or Aaron address the false positive tests in Tanzania where fruit was being tested positive for the Chinese virus? I've not heard of this. Have you guys heard about this?
I haven't heard it, but I can say that the
I think
false
this was a joke. I don't know if this was actually real.
Yeah, but I can tell you false positives that we've seen with the RNA testing early on. Mm-hmm. There were some studies coming out where up to 48% of those tests were false positive. And again, we had people modeling just positive cases, and it was your vanity metric. Mm-hmm. What does that even mean? Because some of them were false positive.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Here's the other one here, which is Dr. Fauci is the perfect case for why term limits aren't just necessary for politicians, but bureaucrats as well. What do you think, Dr. Rose?
There's no question. I think we need term limits. I think we need a smaller bureaucracy. And I think that's why the deep state is pushing so hard right now. Because in the past 3 years, we've seen attack after attack on our president and his family. And they've all been shown to be false attacks, wrong. And our president has stood strong in all that time. So we not only need term limits, I think it's imperative that we support President Trump and that we start to encourage our elected representatives to start shrinking the size of government. They're not going to like it, but we have actually gotten to experience. You started the show with this tyranny firsthand. I mean, we have so many local and state officials, you know, getting in touch with their inner Maduro or something,
it's like the Eva Peron type.
Yeah, and just locking it down.
So I got the Guardian here. It says Tanzania president shrugs off COVID-19 risk after sending fruit for tests. So that is very interesting.
Yeah, I watched his statement. I couldn't tell if he was being serious or not. I'll be honest. So I don't know.
This is the Guardian. So I mean, it's not. They're usually wrong anyway.
But so. I can tell you that even in a lot of governments inside of Africa don't have really reliable statements.
Can you,
sometimes.
Yes. Can you either explain the false positive thing?
Go ahead. I can.
So the PCR test, which measure viral prevalence. Presence, you have to think of it as like a range, right? It is not an absolute statement in terms of like I would say, like, does God exist? Like, it's yes or no sort of statement. It's more of a range of sensitivity, right? So this is why, which a lot of people don't know, that even if you test negative and you have symptoms, they tell you to act positive,
right? And if you test positive and you don't have symptoms, mm-hmm. they tell you, and you don't show any symptoms for a few days, you're okay. And the false positives, again, it's all these metrics are, it's a gateway to further understanding. You have to dig deeper. So if you have a test that's, it may be positive, it may be false positive, you have to look at the patient and see if they have symptoms.
Yes.
And they may have been exposed, so they're positive, but they're not positive for active disease.
Yeah. And then, like, I mean, I'm very pro testing. We need lots of testing.
Anybody testing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we need testing, but we also realized that, for example, for the South Korea, which we had some quote unquote reinfections, which were actually just false positives,
correct.
Right? So we have to understand there's limitations to our own testing, and the fact of if you throw in the like, we don't know where these people are on the symptomatic curve. We have open questions about pre-symptomatic testing. It seems like there is a very, very high false negative rate on those. In terms of, like, if you're pre-symptomatic, the error rates greatly increase.
And I think so. Something to drive home too is it'd be great to have a vaccine, but vaccines aren't the end all, especially when you're dealing with influenza.
Do you have any worries about the potential vaccine?
Well, with all the data coming out and with the certain forces that are moving around it, yes, I do.
What are your worries?
Well, look, in 2018, I mean, Dr. Fauci said himself, the vaccine was only 30% effective. There are some adverse reactions to vaccine. I think that's a decision that you make talking to your doctor, but you don't stop an economy and say we're waiting on a vaccine, because it's not like smallpox. It's not like polio. This is completely different. This is an upper respiratory disease that is similar to an influenza, and we know what it is and we know how it functions. So, again, we need more transparency. We don't need an all or nothing response. And I've heard, and the reason I'm saying that is people are saying we need to wait till we have a vaccine before we open up. Mm-hmm. And there's other ways to treat this. Sure. And that's a fallacy.
Let's close on this. What do you think the cultural impact for America is? Where do we go from here? I know for one, we can either go one of two ways. We can completely abdicate all of our authority to now authoritarian tyrants that have no interest in continuing the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. Or absent of this horrible chapter in American history because of the deaths and the viral infections and also the shutdowns, which are two separate things, we have to always separate them. I actually think we might enter the greatest freedom renaissance in American history.
But
what do you think?
I would like to return 2020 because it was like run by the people who made the Fyre Festival or something. Like it's so disappointing because we had so much opportunity to not only have the greatest sort of set records in terms of unemployment and wealth creation. But I mean, we have lost basically all the gains in terms of, especially among the vulnerable communities in our country. Historically, what happens is that we completely forget about the virus, just like past 1918, Hong Kong flu.
The only difference, though, is we didn't forget about 9/11.
No, we didn't.
No, I know, but a lot of that was
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, sure, but the. But my point is the fact of, like, what we remember will be the policy implications
That's correct.
Of that decision.
Yes.
But
we must remember that we were lied to and misled by these so-called experts.
Mm. We're either going to have the Great Awakening. We're going to have the Great Awakening to realize what it means to have and keep it, to keep freedom. You know, when she asked Benjamin Franklin when he left Independence Hall, do we have a republic? You do, madam, if you can keep it. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the words that we have to look at as American citizens Amen. Right now. Freedom is our birthright. In the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, those were our birth certificates. And it's our responsibility as free citizens to keep it. Now, we've seen what can happen when you don't. And I think it's going to be – I pray that we're going to keep it.
Laws of nature and nature's God, and we definitely went against that right. during all this. You guys, thanks so much for watching. This conversation has been great. Freedom@charliekirk.com, where they can learn more about Aaron.
You just follow me on Twitter, AGINNT.
And –
I have the Scalpel podcast.
Yeah, you know what? Let's promote that. I think you're going to get a surge of listeners. I'll tell you what.
I just do it because it's cheaper than therapy.
That's good. Scalpel, is that the Scalpel?
The podcast? Scalpel podcast. The Scalpel with Dr. Keith Rose. And it's
check it out.
At the Scalpel
Edge
Twitter.
Give him a subscribe button, and that will help you a lot.
And
so
if you want to learn about this, the last several have been on a lot of what we're talking about. Yeah.
God bless everybody. Have a great night.
What an unbelievable discussion that was. Email me your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com, and if you want to get involved with Turning Point USA, go to tpusa.com right now, tpusa.com, chip in some money, start a chapter, get engaged, get involved to help us win America's culture war. At Turning Point USA, we play offense with a sense of urgency to win America's culture war. Get engaged, get involved, contact us, Let us know how we can help you at tpusa.com. And finally, email us your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. I am giving away 10 more copies of signed copies of the MAGA Doctrine. I can read off a list of names of people that won in previous episodes. Fred and Carl and Erica, so many others. But if you guys right now email me, freedom@charliekirk.com, and are able to be one of the first 10 people that email us, freedom@charliekirk.com, you will win a signed copy of the MAGA Doctrine. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. God bless you. God bless our great country. Till next time. Thanks so much.